you have a summary of evidence, perhaps you can read this.
Just before I start on the summary of evidence, I thought I'd just quickly address a question from Commissioner Hudson with regards to a residential flat and the question to Mr. Snodgrass with regards to the potential for two dwellings being positioned within each building platform, which would be anticipated by the zone. The definition under the TNP for a residential flat limits a flat to 70 square metres. And that, so the actual built form outcome is by no means going to be, visually seen as two residential dwellings on site. The intention of the residential flat definition has always been that there is a secondary or an accessory built form element to the main residential dwelling. And a really good point which highlights that is Mr. and Mrs. Burden's existing dwelling has a residential flat attached to it. So the overall area of that dwelling, I understand, is 330 square metres, which includes that flat. So that just gives a good sort of example on a, you know, on a visual perspective, and I presume you saw that on your site visit of what an outcome of a residential flat can look like, and it's not two distinct dwelling forms, which is, I guess, what my understanding of Snodgrass is concerned with.
Now, Mr. Gross, on the basis that the REC staff recommendation in the definitions hearing is that the definition of residential flat be 150 square metres in the rural zones, would that cause you to alter your view?
Well, it certainly makes the dwelling bigger, flat bigger, undoubtedly. But it's still, I mean, I guess Mr. and Mrs. Burden's dwelling is 330, it's still going to be a secondary element to the main residential unit, and, you know, it's not unheard of a 150 square metre garage in a rural type setting. So it's, whilst it probably makes the visual effect a little bit larger, it still doesn't remove the fact that it's a secondary element to the main dwelling. But thank you, I wasn't aware of that either.
Thank you. Carol?
Well, before we leave that point, I'd just like to ask a follow-up question. That is whether there is a rule requiring a flat to be part of the one building, or whether they can be separated.
Under the operative plan, it has to be attached. Under the PDP, my understanding, and I don't have the definition in front of me, but it can be detached.
Thank you. Ms. Snodgrass, if they call Mr. Grace, carries on with his evidence, it seems only reasonable to ask you, based on the information that Mr. Grace has provided us with, if we assumed that a residential flat could be up to 150 square metres, you said initially that two dwellings on each building platform would change your opinion about the overall effect. Based on the information we had this morning, can you comment further on whether you still say the same, that the main dwelling and the
other
flat up to 150 square metres?
Two large dwellings. I think it would be acceptable if it was within the same building platform as the main dwelling. So it would be one collective closely related built form. And yes, I still think that would be acceptable and would be appropriate to the zone.
Okay, thank you.
And are those building platforms you've defined 1,000 square metres?
No, the flexibility and within that area for a building platform to be located. In the whole, if that makes sense.
So how big's the...
That they differ.
And what's the rate?
I don't know, off my head on.
Can you please?
You're talking about the buildable or the building platform areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The buildable.
Yeah.
Basically, the whole of the VRA.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
I'll use the sonograph to calculate that off your plan if you prepare that with the tax commission.
I imagine it's good at volunteering other people. Because I can relate to that. You have a family, a long line of people who are good at volunteering other people's services. So that's not the second, there's no grasp. While Mr. Greaves has generously volunteered your services, happy to receive that as an email to Ms. Prendergast. Like I'm more concerned that you're comfortable that what you give me is right than that it's fast.
Yeah, I don't have any
scale
or anything on, so yeah, I could
just
give it an
extra. Okay, that's great.
If it's alright with you, Chair, I'll start at paragraph 1.2.
Yes, please.
The submission from Leslie and Jerry Burden is the inclusion of their site in the rural lifestyle zone. The submission includes a proposed no-build restriction area over much of the site with five discrete locations identified for house sites, one of which will include the existing residents. The submission also seeks the inclusion of a new objective, policies and rules that specifically relate to future development within the site. One of the key resource management issues is the landscape and visual effects arising from the proposed rezoning. The site sits within an outstanding natural landscape. Ms. Snodgrass has set out within her evidence the key findings with respect to the potential effects on the landscape and visual amenity values as a result of the proposed rezoning. Ms. Snodgrass's opinion is that suitable mitigation of the proposed zoning can be absorbed into the site without adversely affecting landscape values. Ms. Snodgrass also opines that with the addition of native planting on the site, the naturalness of the site will be enhanced with severe positive landscape effects. For the purposes of my evidence, I accept and adopt Ms. Snodgrass's assessment. There appears to be some level of agreement from Mr. Barr and Ms. Mouthlock for the council that this site can absorb additional residential development. However, Mr. Barr prefers the retention of the site within the rural zone and reliance on the rural zone provisions to manage the effects of this development. My opinion differs in that I consider that the planning framework of both the rural lifestyle chapter and subdivision chapter of the PDP and the additional provisions recommended in this submission provide council with a robust planning framework to manage any adverse effects from the development and promote positive ecological enhancements. This planning framework will ensure the proposed rezoning avoids inappropriate subdivision use and development within the hour now through locating proposed development within parts of the site that are capable of absorbing change from a landscape effects point of view, the avoidance of any development from the most prominent and sensitive parts of the site, and ensuring built form will be discrete from important viewpoints such as the State Highway, Lake Hawea and the surrounding beaches. And the proposed rezoning will enhance the natural character of the site, resulting in a positive contribution to the wider landscape appreciation of the Olamau setting. I note that there are a number of submissions on the PDP that seek to change the discretionary status of subdivision rule 27.4.1 to a controlled activity. The council officers in their assessment of these submissions have recommended a change to restrict discretionary. Any change in status to Rule 27.4.1 will have no bearing on the level of control for future development on this site. Any future houses will require the establishment of a building platform under Rule 22.4.3.3, a full discretionary. It is my opinion that the relief sought in this submission is consistent with the operative and proposed regional policy statement. It is also my opinion that the relief sought in this submission is consistent with the higher order PDP provisions of the strategic direction and landscape chapters. The proposed rezoning will enable rural living development within an ONL that can absorb change, while sensitive parts of this landscape will be protected from any further development for the life of the PDP. Policy 6.3.1.6 of the PDP is particularly relevant to this point. This policy promotes enabling rural lifestyle living through applying rural lifestyle zone and rural residential zone plan changes in areas where the landscape can accommodate change. This evidence, and in particular that from Ms. Snodgrass, confirmed that this scenario should be applied to this site. Overall, I consider the proposed zone change of the site to a rural lifestyle zone with the inclusion of additional provisions in the PDP provides a comprehensive solution for the development of the site, along with suitable long-term protection of the site's important values. It is my opinion that the zone change, when assessed against the requirements of Section 32, is consistent with achieving the purpose of the RMA. I'm happy to answer questions from the panel.
Thank you. Chris, first question for me. Paragraph 13 suggested objectives and policies. Policy A, first bullet point, prohibiting development over sensitive areas through the non-restriction areas. Do you think that non-compliant status of the rules is consistent with that?
No, it's not. Restricting or limiting would be a better word to...
that's right. In view of the nature of the case that you're presenting on planning grounds, should it be prohibiting in both places?
I'm comfortable with the non-compliant status under Rule 22.4.15 gives a high level of control in terms of any development that was put forward in a no-build restriction area.
And so presumably you would follow that you're comfortable with non-complying status for maximum height with sentences of maximum height too for the same reason.
Correct.
And in terms of these rules that you've given us, you've told us the non-DCs. Do I understand from your summary that compliance is still a discretionary activity, full discretionary activity?
Correct. Any future development within this zone will require the identification of a building platform, which is limited to five, one being only the existing residence, and that under the rule Uh, 22.4.3.3 is a full discretionary activity in the PDP.
So did you see that number again, please?
22.4, yep. 0.3.
Thank you.
And in terms of your planning assessment, is the reality that you stand or fall on Ms. Snodgrass's landscape assessment?
Correct.
No pressure on Ms. Snodgrass. And in terms of the operation of rezoning in the context of the PDP as a whole, have you considered the implications of rezoning might be, depending on the ultimate form of Chapter 6, take this area of land out of the O&L?
Yes, and I talked to Ms. Snodgrass at length when we were looking at the initial stages of assessment of development options for this site, and Ms. Snodgrass was very clear to me that he could not support the removal of the site from the old now, and on that basis it wasn't that legitimate to look at addressing that point.
No, my point rather is that the way the plan is designed, that might happen automatically.
Because of the rezoning?
Yes.
My view is that there's no reason, and you can take this back to the context of Part 2 of the Act, there's no reason a rural lifestyle zone can't be within an O&L landscape. And I think the key to that in a planning context is it needs to be identified on the planning map, but you also need that link to provisions within the plan, which we would have in this case.
So it might be an O&L with small a, small a, N, small l, but it's still
correct.
Now, in terms of your discussion, paragraph 57. We're talking here about costs and trouble of getting a resource consent in an O&L. We're talking about planners, landscape architects, engineers, significant time, considerable cost. Suppose devil's advocate question is, well, if it's an O&L, shouldn't we have that level of scrutiny to whether it's a resource consent or a rezoning application?
So you're going to have a high level of scrutiny for a future resource consent application under the rural lifestyle zone provisions I've put forward. I think the key difference in my mind is notification, to be fair. Under a rural general, there's almost an expectation for the QRDC resource consent planners that application within an R&L for residential development is in almost all circumstances on probably aware of two in my 7 years working with district where that hasn't occurred, and there's been hundreds. So it comes down to I guess those costs at that as part of that extending that process. I'm not suggesting that the level of information that would be required to support an application through the council wouldn't need to be detailed in this case. And just going further than that, there's nothing that prevents this from being notified, to be fair, because of the full discretionary status. That could well eventuate, but I think the likelihood, given that there's an anticipated level of residential development, is possibly less.
You consider the potential operation of the Act post the 2017 amendments as they relate to notification?
No, I haven't, sir.
I was hoping you could tell me what they were, because I haven't had time to read them. They're broadly, because I can sympathise with that view. I'm wondering about your reasoning in paragraph 59. I wondered if, given the site is actually quite confined, whether it's whether that's really a fact that would weigh with us, whether in fact you would ever get a sufficiently confined resource consent that you wouldn't take into account the balance of a 38 hectare.
I accept that there's an application for resource consent could quite conceivably address all the attributes of the wider site, absolutely. But I think this, what I'm trying to say here is this gives that certainty, where that certainty wouldn't exist under a resource consent.
Like there are, the reason, the thing that prompts my question is tomorrow we're hearing from the Blenheim Bay team who are proffering zone provision of the road to 2,800 hectares in relation to 170 hectare actual developed area.
Right.
That's what that's a problem.
Yes, I understand. And,
so this is obviously quite a different scale.
I was just going back to paragraph 13 and your recommended objectives and policy. You've referred to the natural landscape and visual amenity value as experienced from the Maikawarau Lake Harbour Road. Township and Lake Harbour. Why not further afield? Is that objective intended to limit the extent to which any visual effect or effect on the landscape would be assessed?
The key visual locations that Ms. Snodgrass has identified, and I think once you mitigate the effect from those key points, then anything further that is, you know, probably top of mountains. In my experience, I think once you've mitigated the effect from those viewpoints, you in turn have probably mitigated from further afield. And I think it's good as part of that policy to draw one's attention to what we consider to be the key location so that it's actually responded to for a resource consent process.
Ms. Snodgrass also referred to the little township, the other end of the lake.
So that would be Catson.
So that's Catson.
And the Lake Howard, in my view. I mean, that's right on the beach, effectively.
It's the Gladstone Gap, effectively.
Correct, yeah, just moving around.
You are saying that the assessment of building platforms is a full discretionary activity. How matters of design, building design, address in the provisions that you're recommending?
Under the operative versus this plan, the PDP that we're dealing with, it's different. And the issue of design. Effectively, once a building platform is established, a house within the platform is a permitted activity under this plan. And saying that there will be standards that those buildings need to meet under the plan, and the key ones being obviously the height limits that we've recommended, but also there is a standard for building materials and colours, which is rule 22.5.1. That's critically important in terms of the actual external appearance, and the external appearance on the building will need to be recessive to comply with that rule. So just any development within the zone would be captured by that rule. The actual design element is unlikely to be captured at a building platform or subdivision stage. In saying that, it's not uncommon when you establish a building platform, particularly under subdivision, to impose consent notice conditions, to limit things such as height limit or material and colour. But in saying that, I feel like probably the standards in the PDP are stronger on those issues than the OEP, particularly that building material and colour.
So, consent notice conditions on subdivision, are they the result of the council wanting those? Or is it more of an OGA sort of...
In my experience, these here are often offered by the applicant.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mm. So, Ms. Snodgrass was, if I've understood her evidence correctly, reliant on there being good mitigation of, through good building design as a meeting their objectives to ensure that they are not prominent in the landscape. So, is it your advice that the PDP provision, in addition to the modifications that you suggested, work through that?
Yes, that's correct.
You're quite confident. So, when you say that you get those conditions usually offered by the applicant of tiny subdivision, does that create any sort of gap in your opinion?
No, I think in the cases we can see that it's often rural segments zoning under the OEP. I'm comfortable that with the height limit, the building material and colours rule that's within the PDP. You've also got to remember there's sizes on, there's a maximum building size that's recommended, which is 500 square metres, which will limit the build form within the building platform. But I'm quite comfortable that with the bulk and location rules and the visual appearance rules around the set of colours, there's enough of a frame back there that will manage the effects that Ms. Snodgrass has discussed.
I asked Ms. Snodgrass what made this site any different from other lakeside strips, and I'd be interested in more comments about that too.
Yes. When I first visited the site, in my view it is actually quite a unique site, particularly from a visibility perspective. It's not prominent from the road, and it's also not prominent from the immediate adjoining beach, and that's largely to do with the terrace formation where these building sites would sit. And I think that's really important here, which is quite a unique characteristic of this site, which gives, based on the Snodgrass evidence, gives that capacity to absorb this development. Its location in relation to Lake Hawea and its immediate, you know, its location in close proximity to the Lake Hawea Township also assists in, from a visual appreciation point of view, it isn't going to be a surprise is probably not the right word, but it isn't out of the ordinary that you have some form of rural living development adjoining a township such as Lake Hawea. I mean, take Wanaka for example. You only need to go down Mount Aspiring Road and view, you know, you get a sort of transition from this township into sort of more of a rural living type development. And that section of Mount Aspiring Road adjoining the lakefront is sort of an example, I guess, I think this is a better, this will ultimately be a better example because of the level of mitigation we're offering, but that sort of context is what I'm talking about here, and sort of the further you go out of town, then you get less development.
Did you consider the
Lake Hawea
comments of Numpop in relation to potential for sprawl as a result of combination of the requests from Mr. Nicky Shrewden here today and the interview which we had yesterday from other members of the building family?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think the issue of sprawl almost is probably resulted from the shape of this property in terms of it's a long, narrow property that follows the boundary of the road, the state highway, sorry, and the lake. In response to that, I probably need to rely on the sonographs as evidence, because I think the critical aspect of the critical effect is the result of sprawl as a landscape effect. And I don't think there's any sort of other particular planning implications of that in the sonographs as addressed that within her reply.
There we go. The one of the key components is zone change versus resource consent application. Obviously, zone change from you is the way to go.
Yes, I think. I mean, in this case, it's, as I refer to in my evidence, there's actually a directed policy within the higher order PDP provisions that where there is capability to absorb development, which I feel like we've presented a case that there is on this site, that consideration does need to be given to a zone change, and that's what we've put forward here.
And that's even... after hearing Council's rebuttal when the opinion is still that it's best administered to the conditions of resource consent, and after the list of 11.9 in Council's statement of evidence, which you referred to in your evidence,
mm-hmm.
and you feel that they've all been satisfied from the address to the application.
Yes, I think this zone and the provisions we've put forward set the framework that will comprehensively address the key issues.
And with the objectives, policies and rules, can you give me your understanding of appropriate ongoing controls to manage and remove pests and weed species? This goes back to the discussion I was having with Ms. Snodgrass about the Ms. Melsop's consideration that
mm-hmm.
large-scale successful indigenous planting is hard to. There are no examples in the district. So how would you? What would you say would be appropriate ongoing controls?
I think there are examples in the district where it has been.
Can you give me some, please, sir?
Emerald Bluffs, a good example. Closed-in Station is a good example. Both comprehensive revegetation that probably go far beyond the scope of that. From what's required, but I think it's important to note that it is feasible and possible, and I completely accept that it has to be done, has to be managed right, but it can be done. I don't think it's incorrect to assume that it can't be done, it can be done. Look, I'm no expert on pest and weed control, but I would expect that, you know, to give effect to that policy, there would need to be some management plan put in place that would be enforced through a resource control process.
Which leads me rather nicely on to the suggestion that specific rules, recalls, which was suggested by Council,
mm-hmm.
specific rules requiring a management plan identified, including matches, searches, surveys, appropriate for qualified person, identification of areas to be retained in the stores and planting and maintenance regime should be offered by way of supplementary rules. Do you think that's a reasonable thing to ask? And would that be something that you would offer?
My initial response to that is I believe the discretionary framework, what's the building platform consent under
22.4.3.3.
You'll have to give it that number again, sorry. Was it? 22.4.3.3. There's sufficient scope within that role being a full discretionary activity to give effect to the policy to actually achieve that outcome that Mr. Barr has discussed. However, in saying that, if the panel needed more certainty to achieve the level of revegetation or ecological enhancement which we've been discussing today, then there's absolutely scope to include an additional rule to require that.
would it be appropriate to ask if that was to be done? Could it be volunteered? And
well, the next question is clearly, if there were to be such a rule, what the words would be. Can I invite, unfortunately this is not something you can refer to, it's not grass. Happy for you to provide it on a without prejudice basis, because to be honest, I understand your opinion, but if we were to decide that that was desirable, it would be helpful if we started with your words and had Mr. Barr's reply.
I have, in this morning's proceedings, written a very quick draft of something on how that would work. I can read it out to you, and it might not be the final format, but if you want to hear it now.
No, I think that we prefer your considered view.
Okay, yep.
Rather than something you might regret in the morning.
Yes, I understand.
And the other thing, the next morning is always the best test. The other question for you, and given that I'm looking over your right shoulder, Mr. Burton Jr., is do you think, in terms of the optimum planning outcome, it would be desirable, in fact, that there was one rural lifestyle zone with comprehensive management plan, structure plan, whatever the planning framework is, across both properties?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
So, I understand this is not now your day job, but if you could get us those words at latest by 5 p.m. on the 14th of June.
And as long as last time, absolutely. Yep. That shouldn't take me long.
One's over got both properties, that might also go partway to addressing Mr. Barr's concern about a multiplicity of spot zones with bespoke provisions.
I understand, yep.
So if you could think about that too.
Yep.
And, possibly discuss it with Mr. Edgar.
Mr. White?
Yeah, Mr. White.
Good answer. Thank you for that clarification. With the Glen Dean photo,
yes.
Mr. White.
And can I just clarify, would you like something from both? What is Mr. White going away to think about this issue? What?
No, because I'm only just saying that.
Okay.
This will come as an unpleasant surprise to Mr. White. That if you can reach a consensus, that would obviously be helpful. And if you can't reach a consensus, if you could tell us that.
Understand. And this is specifically in relation to the marine education, or we need to go wider than that?
Well, I think it would be wider. I think that both properties you're talking about building restriction areas as a primary control, in this case more extensive than on the Glen Dean, but both vegetation is a key consideration.
Mm-hmm.
But put your heads together and see what you can come up with.
Can we take also potentially doing driveways?
Oh yes, and also rationalisation of the number of driveways might be helpful. Any more for any more?
Yes.
That's all from us. Thank you very much.
What? Just one. I was just wondering, with one of the rules, it's got rule 2, and you've got non-compliance with this rule to be a non-complying activity. Could you explain that? Or is that just planner speak and I've just got it wrong because I don't know?
It's a status that if you didn't comply with that rule, you require a non-complying resource consent.
It's beautiful. Right. And as we're doing that, let's just chop through. One final question with regards to the to consider the cost recovery or not in terms of reserves consent application. As someone who experienced a bit of, I can understand and sympathise with that, but surely, essentially, and I don't want to put words in the mouth, but that's just the nature of the beast in terms of the level of certainty and information expected for something that is undertaken in the OML. So therefore, probably shouldn't be considered. Does that make sense? Or I might have got that wrong. Is there a question in there, you think? No, it's just the cost recovery. You obviously put a bit of emphasis on the fact that there is a significant cost to be paid. And I understand that, but isn't that just the nature of the beast that we're dealing with? That there will be costs that will be incurred, and it's not necessarily a consideration for this panel.
Yeah, it's absolutely something that eventuates under any resource mapping, resource consent process. The level where I was going to is that this provides a little bit more certainty to the Mr. and Mrs. Burden in terms of the outcomes, where that certainty doesn't exist under the rural zone, so you can potentially go a long way spending a lot of money to get nowhere.
Who would do that?
Thank you. Sorry, that's me now. Thank you.
Mr. Jackson, that's it from us. So if you have any concluding points you would
like to make? I was actually going to seek your leave to have until the 14th of June myself to perhaps compile not only the material last of Mr. Grass, but also that from Mr. Snodgrass. And if there are any matters I wish to raise when I close it, if I can call it that, then I do it then. I'm certainly not looking to introduce anything.
Happy with that. Since we've given Mr. Reeves until the 14th, then I think it's totally fair that Mr. Snodgrass had the same.
Yes.
And as I say, if you wish to make closing remarks, but you'll bear in mind that what I'm interested in is closing remarks and not anything.
No, absolutely. And at this stage, I don't anticipate that I will, but it's sort of might be more assistance if the material came through one person.
And it just occurred to me, and it's for Mr. Greaves, and it's to do with the building restriction area. When is a bra? When is a restriction? What is the life of the building restriction area? Because I see you mention it being the life of the plan.
Yes, well, that's correct. That's the life of the plan, because under any new district plan review process, then reconsideration can be given to the planning framework that relates to that zone, just as we're talking about today. So I don't think plans do have a definitive period or life period, so I can't sit here and say that that's for perpetuity, because it may be reconsidered under a new planning process.
And for Commissioner McLeod, the way you would lock that in would be with consent notices on title, wouldn't it?
Correct.
Thank you for that clarification, sir.
Well, let me see if that's enough. I think that is genuinely all we need. So, Mr. Jackson, you have until the 14th at 5 p.m. to the Hearing Administrator package for this. And thank you very much for your attendance and for the wider Burden family. Then we have Mr. Hughes next on the same subject, but so thank you for your feelings. We appreciate you coming and contributing to this.
Thank you.
Thank you. How's your coffee pot? Thank you.
from Mr. Hughes. You have the floor.
Good, thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Dennis Hughes.
And I'm Ross Hughes.
Sort of like Ross.
Thanks. This is we like the two office.
We're further submitted. This is a further submission. And it relates to, of course, to the version submission 581. It's interesting, I wrote this submission, or we wrote this submission, probably more than a year ago. And we submitted it online. It seemed to go missing online, and then it was found, and so I rewrote it. But this, really, the submission that you have in front of you is what we wrote over a year ago, just with a little bit responding to the Section 42A report. But you might ask, why a huge submission about the burden proposal? Many, many months ago, probably 15 or 16 months ago, Mr. and Mrs. Burden were at a community event, and they told us, and I had known about their proposed development of their site. They asked if we'd care to support it. And I was probably almost a bit rude. I said, oh, well, we'll think about it. and I'm making that point. I want to reassure the panel that we've taken a very independent stance. We're not friends of the Burdens. We're not close family friends. As members of the Hawea community, we have over the years rubbed shoulders with the Burdens, gotten to know them. And in that time, we've come to like them, respect them, and most of all appreciate, particularly with Jerry and Leslie, their love of their land. And I like the way you responded to Jerry's comment this morning. I'm not a developer, I'm a farmer. And that carried a lot of weight with us. So anyhow, over the next week, Rod and I spoke about it, and I went back to Mr. Burden and said, yes, whether we can support you or not, I don't know, but we'd like to have a look at it. And if we feel we can support you, we will. But it may well end up that we become bitter enemies. We may oppose the development. And she laughed and said, well, what do you want? And I said, well, we'd like to see all the paperwork. I knew about Section 32 reports. We'd like to walk over it without you and with you. We'd like access. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, sure. So 2 or 3 weeks later, I said, we're ready, the users are ready to do their homework. And we went out, all the paperwork was there, and we sat down and we reviewed every bit of paperwork. They said we could take it away and copy things. We didn't. I subsequently did ask for a copy of the Section 32 report. We walked over it. Then I asked Jerry if at some stage we could come back and he could show us where these four sites would be, the building platforms. We stood on them, and we left it at that. Unbeknownst to the Burdens, we made our own provisions. I didn't ask them to take us out on a boat. We asked a neighbour, and we live at Lake Hawea, I might say. We live in what was Ross's parents' little crib, 1960s crib, one of the first that was built over on the foreshore, and Ross inherited part of it, and we now own all of it. So we have a knowledge of the land, we love the area, and so we decided there's three neighbours, we all work together, we look after each other's property. One of our neighbours lives in Hong Kong, another one lives in Invercargill, I do their lawns, we all look after each other's property. And one of them bought a new boat. And I said, now it'd be lovely if you'd take us out in your new boat, and he was very keen to. So one day we went out all over the lake. As we got up near the Burden property, I said, would you just slow down, we want to take some photos. And Roz took the photos, which I must say look pretty dark and pretty gloomy. They're not photo. She hasn't done any photo improvements. And we took those series of photos as we were trying to review the impact from the lake. So that's the background. This could well have been a submission today when we were critical or opposing the development, but we're not. So we took into a lot of the factors that you've spoken about. I've been very interested in your questions because we have exactly, and still have some of those questions in mind. We looked at it as a development in an outstanding natural landscape. A particular site, I have to say, I don't think is an outstanding natural landscape. It's It's an ordinary, unremarkable piece of the hardware foreshore. In some ways, it's a bit scruffy at the present time. But it does sit in what we regard as an outstanding natural landscape. We regard all of those hills from behind Glendean, the lake, the foreshore, the mountains at the head of the lake, and when we look out to Timaru Creek, we just think the whole damn lot is an outstanding natural landscape, and that includes the skies above it. So we love that area, and while it's been in the Burden family, and Jerry's walked those hills since he was a boy, we also have, well, mainly sitting on our decking and looking and imagining of what it would be like, but we regard that landscape as ours. I have two sons who live overseas. One of them the other day said, "Dad, would you send me some photos of the lake?" And I said, "Oh God, Antoine, you've got hundreds of photos, so just send me some." He regards all of that area as an outstanding natural landscape. And we don't look at it as Burden property or government reserve or whatever. We regard that we all own it. We love the area. And the concept of an outstanding natural landscape, we like that concept. We think the whole area is outstandingly wonderful and worth preserving. So we set a very high bar. So we did our homework over a number of months, and we've actually found it quite easy to support what's going on. In fact, we're quite relaxed about future development on it. So our assessment in sum total, we've stood on the four proposed building platforms. We've looked at them. We've gone down onto the foreshore. And Mr. Greaves has pointed out, when you're down on the foreshore, because of the natural erosion that has occurred in the last 50 years since the lake has been lifted, there's quite a high cliff there, and when you're down on the foreshore, you'll look up, you're hard-pressed to see any development there. Quite relaxed about that. We'll talk about our photographs after that we took from the lake when we went out on the lake there. Again, we're quite comfortable that this will be quite easy to achieve what the Snodgrass hopes, to get visual screening both from the highway behind and from the lake in front. We think will be relatively easy. As she said, even if you built places there and left the scrub and the bracken to grow, things grow quite well there, even though we've been in a drought. There's enough seepage off the hill there. So it's a site that I think has a lot of potential in terms of growth and development, etc. I'm sure you'll need people with some motivation in terms of planting plans, etc., but it will be very easy to mitigate effects through growth. So in sum total, we see no visual impacts in terms of from the lake, from the highway beyond, as we'll show you with the photographs. There's a steady fall from the highway down to the lake, and if you pull over at the side of the highway and look there, you immediately look across the lake. You have to, and this is in relation to your questions, Commissioner Hudson, you have to actually consciously look down at this 32 hectare site. And the steady fall, and I would imagine it won't at all be challenging to plant beyond the residences, and I would be confident enough to say if there's a bit of motivation in terms of the planting plan, you won't see any buildings from the road. Where am I? The other thing here, we have history on our side. And I brought something along, a little delicacy for you, Commissioner Callum. A quote, knowing how much you like quotes. The further back you know, the further ahead you can comfortably go. That was from one of your countrymen, or it was actually from Winston Churchill who said that. And
not one of my countrymen, but...
What's that?
No, quite.
He's English, not really one of your countrymen, but he saved your bacon at one stage.
Did he?
Yes. But there is a lot of history here, and one of the factors of history that came in when we were there, we decided, well, let's have a look at the two existing Burden residences, both of which Leslie and Jerry created. I've got 1978. I hear Jerry this morning said the Glendean Station Homestead was built in 1979. As we'll show you from the photograph there, you're hard pressed to actually see from several positions on the lake to more than catch a glimpse of that homestead. In fact, Ros, you might like to just show the photographs now, speak very briefly to them in order. These are the same order that you have on our submission.
All right, so looking at photo one.
Excuse me, sorry for interrupting. I've gone back to your original submission, and I can't find photos.
It's in submission 1101.
Yes, I've got that, but we've got a
All right, so I've got a copy here for you.
It's also the point 8, the...
So the photographs that you've got in, I just had these blown up the other day, just for Ross's purposes. Ross, you carry on.
So Dinos has explained the purposes of these photos. It was our way of researching, and these four photos are only some of the number of photos that we took and pored over looking at them in detail. The first photo shows the site down here. And I was really interested earlier on when you were talking about perspective and putting this in perspective of the whole site. Unfortunately, I couldn't fit the whole site in, and I couldn't fit the whole mountain in behind. But when you're out in a boat and you look at the site here, you actually don't look at the site because your eyes are captivated by the mountain. It is so strong and majestic that you end up looking at the mountain, and so this site down here pales in significance, really. But anyway, that's the site that we're talking about. And if you follow the tree line along, that's where the highway is. So you can see there's already some screening in place. And you can see how the section, the site, falls away down towards the lake. There's just a natural falling down there. Over on the hard right is a building site, and far left.
It's two of the building, of the four buildings.
That was as much as we could get in one photo. But you can see how, as Dennis said, it's not really an area of natural beauty, as in capital letters. It is beautiful, but not. It doesn't really deserve the capital letters. And
just add to the other thing, just picking up on some of the questions, I think it might have been you, Callum, was talking about the site. It is actually a very discrete site, as it's defined by the new highway, the existing highway, and the lakefront, and the steep hills behind it. And so it's a huge contrast with what you talk about, Mr. Chairman, Trevor, in terms of you're dealing with something at Glendu Bay, which is more open. This is very confined, and often even on that part of the day, a bit gloomy, but it's a very distinct piece of our landscape over here.
Right, moving on to photo two. Now, this is closer to the land here. Again, I said we went out in our neighbour's boat, and so we asked them to move in closer.
Probably about 150 metres just offshore there.
So that was going to be my question. So the second photo is 150 metres.
Around about 150, yeah.
Now, at this stage, I was leaning out of the side of the boat, and you can see I've captured a bit of boat in the corner. And I was saying, I'm going to get a photo of the house. And it was really interesting. The neighbour that took us out, she said to me, "What are you taking a photo of?" And I said, "The Burdens house." She said, "Where is it?" So I was really interested in that, that she didn't pick it immediately until we pointed to it.
And they have been, they're a boating family, they fish and they ski, they've been up and down that lake, but they really weren't aware, not that they had looked for it, but there was a problem there.
And you can see how the Burdens have situated their house. It's sort of sideways onto the lake here, so you're not seeing the major part of it. There is planting around it, and the colouring of the house is such that it just blends into the landscape. It just kind of disappears, really. You talk about loud houses, garish houses. This is at the other end of the continuum. This is a very quiet house.
It also speaks to me. I've been the one over the years being very critical of council getting into the idea of painting schemes. And I remember Michael Hill developments and the controversy over that side of the hill. And I used to say, council should stay out of businesses of the colour of your house. But since getting into this exercise looking at the Burden property, I've actually come to appreciate quite carefully to have a palette of colours that fit in and pick up and blend into the hillside. And there, if I showed that photo to many people, they would be hard-pressed to find the property. That property was built in 2003, still growing. And it's still growing in, but really quite a magnificent answer to your questions about colour, light, and vegetation.
Now, just further up in this photo, still in photo 2, you can see there's a lighter coloured area here. That's the hill that is hiding that house from the highway. As you go past on the highway, you can't even catch a glimpse of it. And going down now to the foreshore here, you can see what Dennis was talking about with a bit of a bank here.
Quite steep.
Right. Move along to photo 3. This is the earlier Burden homestead, the one built in 1979. And you can just catch a glimpse of the roof. And it's cut right into the land, it doesn't stand out, the screening in front with these trees, screening behind so you can't see it at all from the highway, and there's just that glimpse of the roof.
Another thing I'd pick up there too is I'm now 72, my history at the Pawea is a 9-year-old while the dam was being built. Ros and I both go there, so we have 62 years of history up there. When we look over towards Glen Dean and these hills that we think we own, the Hughes own them, outstanding natural landscapes. Also, the farming comes into it, and you can see some developed flats there that Jerry talks about, probably some of the first flats that Jerry sat on a tractor and cultivated for the first time. We regard that rural landscape as being part of these outstanding natural landscapes. We love it. And look how well it is blended in. Leslie, when I asked them about this, I told them later, I said, we've been snooping on you and looking at how well you delivered on earlier council requirements for planting. And she said, well, did we do well? Now, the standards that will be set today will be so much higher in the proposed district plan than that they did in 79 or even in 2003. But look what a successful outcome. So that's all part of it. And so it's the nature of where rurality and farming fits into our landscapes. Sorry, Ross, back to you.
As Dennis said, the Burdens' record of citing their houses, the two of them, the colouring that they've chosen, and their efforts at screening were factors that contributed to us agreeing to support them.
Well, not agreeing, but we decided to.
We decided to, yes. Right, photo 4. This was taken closer to our home, back towards the Esplanade and at Lake Hawea.
Probably again about 100 metres off the shore at Esplanade. Well, actually, it's between our place and Gladstone Gap, just further along that photo was taken. So you were talking about the views that you might see from the village of Gladstone or separate. That gives you a pretty good representation.
So from here, there's no sign of Burden's home. None at all.
Now, when we look over there, Ross was here, I arrived up from Dunedin last night on the Boston Building project down there, and I immediately go out onto our decking and I look over. Now, we see no lights from either of the Burden properties or their workers' accommodation or their woolshed. We see no lights whatsoever. We never see any lights. I don't expect that we'll see any lights or reflections of four building platforms on the 38-hectare site. We don't want to see them, we don't expect to see them. That's what we see when we look out at our outstanding natural landscape, and almost all of that landscape in Chapter 5, I suppose, before tenure review, and I don't quite understand how tenure review works, was all part of the Burden farming operation there. All of those hills, we look out there, and again, we see some cultivates, some nice paddocks, and we see the hills. We don't see things changing if there are four properties well built, and with the presupposition that applying for building consents and all of the rules and requirements of the PDB, the Provisional District Plan, which I've read through quite carefully, if they're all applied, we see no downside whatsoever. So it actually proved, I said to Ross, we may be getting into something contentious between us and the Burdens if we don't like what's going on. We have set the bar high, we've actually found it, we feel very comfortable supporting it, and we think that any mitigation effects should be relatively simple. Ross, want to add anything to that?
No, I would just agree wholeheartedly with that.
The new bit of our submission that we wrote over a year ago was the section 42 a hearing report, and we just picked out two sections of this, and it's interesting they've come through and other people that have spoken. The one that really caused us quite a strong reaction was, and I've just quoted it there, the sprawl of domestication, which we attribute to Ms. Melsop. We were a bit incredulous at that. We travel the highway a lot. We will often head across to Makarora to have a ramble and have a coffee and one of the wonderful venison pies. We go across to Haas often just for a day. For a day trip, we'll get up early in the morning and head across to the Haas. And we see no domestication at all. Just as a matter of interest, you know the Hawea Dam, you know what we call the Hawea Turnoff. We came across the dam this morning and we turned left to go along Highway 6 to come into this hearing. I would agree with the description of a sprawl of domestication between the Hawea turnoff and as we come along to Wanaka. You're aware that there's lots more buildings there and people live there. But if we turn right and head over to the coast, we go 4.7, almost 5 kilometres before we come to the first property turnoff. And that's the existing Burdens. And there's a lovely rural turnoff. You're aware that there's a farming operation in there. No such thing as letterboxes now, Callum. I present the rural mail. They go up and they drop their mail at the two properties there. So that's 5 kilometres from the dam to the Burden property. Then you go another 15 to 18 kilometres till you actually do come across a letterbox, and that's up near the neck. And there's a property that you don't see from the road, way up high in the hills. I'm told it belongs to a Mike Yates, I think. And there's a turnoff there. So there's the Burden property. 15 to 18 kilometres further up the road, there's a second turnoff, perhaps a letterbox. And then you proceed over the neck, and you go all the way, I'm thinking about 20 kilometres, till you come to, I think it's West Makarora. So there's no hint of people living alongside the roadway. The only residence that you can see is what I take it to be one of the workers' accommodations on the Burden property. There's one property there that you do see from the road, but you see no others.
So one property does not make a sprawl. Mm.
So we react, we're a bit incredulous of that. The second bullet point we have, and I'm not making a big thing of it, and I'm interested, my perspective is very much the same as Ian Gray's, and we haven't talked about that. I know I've read the PDP from cover to cover. I found it very complicated. I found it tedious reading, but when it first came out, I slogged my way through it. And to do with other submissions that we've made on behalf of the Hawea community, I would have thought, and I'm very comfortable with all the subdivision chapter, I think has a credible amount of detail, and I think sets a pretty high bar. I know the rural lifestyle, I know the rural residential chapters very well because we worked on those. From my naive viewpoint, I would have thought there's a ton of protection if those rules are enforced, and when people apply for building consents, they're prescribed in detail of what people are to do and they're monitored. I would think the risk of any despoilation of the area is minimal. We're quite comfortable. So,
Mr. Hughes,
yes,
I'm happy to hear your views, but I'm concerned that we have another submitter listening, waiting patiently down the phone.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not making much of a point there. I don't have the depth of knowledge that others do, but I would have thought there's plenty there. Moving to our conclusions. We're very comfortable in supporting 581. We're confident that four additional rural lifestyle zone allotments on that site, the site can absorb it quite easily. I have been interested in what they refer to as the VAR, the building restricted area. I've been trying to ascertain what proportion of the site that is. And it's probably upwards of 90% of that 38-hectare site is what is incorporated in that BRA. I would have picked some sort of ecological, if there's some sort of revegetation management plan or weed control plan, I think what we regard at the present time, Ros and I, is a relatively unremarkable site on the side of Te Hawea. It could well be enhanced to be quite a special area. And we foresee that it's got a tremendous amount of potential. So we therefore support the rezoning of the lot to rural lifestyle zone, and we ask that all of submission 581 be allowed.
Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Hughes. Mr. Hudson.
No, thank you. I'm sure the burden's very appreciative of your efforts to take such a lot of trouble to support this submission. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that there are a lot of other submitters in the district that would be very happy to
Well, it could have been a different scenario if we thought our precious landscapes were going to be blotted. It may not have been such a comfortable outcome, but we don't see any downside providing the provisions are enforced in terms of building consents.
And just to activate the comments from Commissioner Hudson, Dennis, you're a credit to the Hawea community. I love your investigative snout. Long may it continue. I would say, however, looking at the photos you presented, the word dark, gloomy, ordinary, unremarkable and scruffy. Have you ever visited Scotland?
Yes, I have.
We love Scotland.
It's beautiful, but it gives you a whole new appreciation of the words dark and gloomy, I have to say. Thank you very much.
Other thing, Trevor, on that day, the wind wasn't blowing. You made a reference this morning, a rather cheeky reference to a windy Lake Hawea. On that day, there was no wind.
Yes, I have been there, and it's gone quite like that. Now, I don't actually have any questions about the evidence you've given. Can I say the photos from offshore are very, very useful, giving a perspective, because while we went on the site, we looked down at from the top of the road, where Mr. Burden pointed out the house sites for us. So seeing it from the opposite side is very useful. I want to remind you of the last time I saw you, which was about 14 months ago, where you appeared at the Stream 1 hearing.
Yes, I remember that.
As I think the immediate past president of the HPA.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you something in that capacity.
Now you're pinning me to the wall. Carry on.
No, not at all. The HCA submission opposes the intensification of rural residential, existing rural residential development found around Lycan Place. And when the submitters who support that intensification appeared, they suggested to us that that view did not represent the view of the community, because it was the product of a meeting in the second week of January that didn't have a great attendance. And out of fairness to you, I wanted to put that to you and invite you to say briefly what your response is.
Yes, okay. There's several points that come out of that, and Mr. Barr may be interested in that too. At that particular meeting, we do have attendances. We had a series of public meetings, and I think, Callum, you were at some of them.
I was.
To do what? The district plan. And we had attendances, I'd have to look at that one, but of 130, 140, 90 huge attendances. That one in January, it was one of two where the issue of the possible intensification of that rural residential block would be. It was huge support. In fact, it dominated the meeting. And I still have notes and I have files. We have big pads of paper where people wrote down their views. So it was overwhelmingly supported, with one or two, in fact I think just one particular couple, that own land in that rural residential area that were opposing it. So there was an overwhelming public support. When our particular plan was put, our proposal to make submissions to the district plan process, and a report was written up, that went to an AGM that was attended by many, and we showed it to the committee, the meeting they had it, and I formally moved that the community would either support or reject that particular stance, and it was supported with, I think, one dissenting voice. I did that with a great deal of confidence, and we thought carefully about it, and we were stepping into it. Something that was a hot potato that one or two landowners in that rural residential area were seeking intensification. The bulk of them were not. So we had the support there. But one of the points that I pointed out to people is that this was our submission in terms of the provisional district plan, that the status of that as rural residential in the what will become the new plan, remains rural residential. But we pointed out very carefully to people that that doesn't preclude when the next plan comes around, it's likely that that will be eroded by intensification. So a bit like the question you were asking about the bra on the Burden property, how long does it survive? And I remember stating that too, that we can't foretell the future, but we can deal with the present. And we were addressing too, and it was a bit of a moral imperative, but the community accepted that when it was spelled out. We have people there that have bought their properties in that rural residential subdivision some 5 or 6 years ago. They're still in the process of developing their properties. When they bought them from the property developer, they were told that this is rural residential, all the properties around here are of 1 acre, you're not going to have any neighbours, etc. And they're still in the process of developing their properties. Their anxieties went up when they felt that we were going to get intensification in that subdivision. So we're saying yes, on behalf of the community, the HCA took a very deliberate stance, and we stepped in and we sort of stood up and spoke for them, and we pleaded to council that the rural residential status be preserved, for the span of the next So we have the support, we have the figures there, and I suspect what you have heard from is one or two people that own property there that are seeking to subdivide.
Just to be clear, when you say support, you mean support for opposition?
Yes. I'm not sure I understand your question.
You said, what I've just written my notes down, when the possible intensification was raised, huge support,
supporting non,
yes.
Supporting preserving the status quo. Yes, well, yes, agree.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes. Any other questions? Commissioners?
No.
Thank you very much for your attendance, Mr. and Mrs. Hughes.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Yes.
I did copy some information, so I've only done four copies, and I do need to read from the first one, perhaps probably the three, and then give you the fourth one as I go.
Maybe best if you hold, give the printout one copy, and you read from your text, and if we know we're going to get a copy, that's the main thing, then we know we've got it right down. But if you say something that's not on the text, make that clear, so then we will write it down.
Yes, well, probably most of the time it's not on the text, but it's pretty good. So firstly, I just wanted to thank the panel very much. Everybody has been involved with the work so far, but that was the really careful consideration that's gone into my submission. And so, really, I'm not very familiar with this process, and I just noticed some things that I really wanted to bring to the attention of planning and the CRDC, looking over as I compile the evidence. I'm quite happy with where the decision's sitting, but I did just notice, which quite concerned me, having been a very long-term resident of the Valley and having had my family live there since 1959.
Well, maybe step back a bit.
Yeah.
Start from where you live and so we understand where you're coming from.
Okay, so going back to my original submission, my father moved to Mackerel in the late 1950s. We've farmed there ever since. Take family there, I've gone back to Nambia, and I've been back there living permanently for the last almost 9 years. So really quite familiar with the terrain, the weather, the rainfall, the hazards, and the local population. And so I'm very excited and thank you very much for that outstanding natural landscape classification and putting recommending to put the zoning back to the rural to protect the outstanding landscape. I guess the hazards and what actually happens in that terrain and that really high rainfall up there of 120 inches per year as opposed to about 12 in Wanaka really concerns me. I'm also the Makarua Fire Chief and I have a role in search and rescue. So when there's a catastrophe or a drama, I'm out there and I'm also very, very hazard conscious and I've seen what's happened, particularly in the last century. We had 100 year floods every 5 years up to close to the year 2000. So I did actually, I just wanted, I hope this is not appropriate, but looking at the maps that were given of the areas that, my first concern, which is perhaps slightly outside the perimeter, is that the township zone.
Can you tell me the number of the map that you've got in your hand?
That was from...
This will be Mr. Barr's end.
Mr. Barr, yes. So I'm looking in Appendix 1, we're on page 4.
It's the rural report page, so. So What page was that?
Page 4 in appendix 1, right at the back.
Yep.
I just noticed in particular the central township area and the associated rural areas recommended to be left as rural lifestyle zones, which just sort of slightly increased that. That when I overlaid what's on the QLDC mapping site, which is obviously reasonably old, it's maybe the photo mapping on there is maybe somewhere between 7 to 10 years old, I guess, by looking at it and looking at dwellings that are present or not present. I just really noticed that a lot of this land, particularly very close to that township area there, has been obliterated by the river. And every time we have a reasonable rainfall, which would be many, many times a year, it's not uncommon to get 3 inches in one night of rain. The river changes course and it eats away quite a lot of the land there. I'm actually just concerned at the proximity of those areas to the river and the fact that a lot of the land has disappeared already. So in the handouts that I give you, apart from having some historical stuff with photos of what's happened in the past, I've actually printed off from the council website the maps of where the title blocks in the land overlay the aerial photographs and highlighted in yellow this map of areas which have already been lost. And when we get to the page relating to that Makarora Central Township zone, there is a map of, and I've labelled it, there's more than half the, all that green area you see there between the township and the river is completely gone. The river's right, if not already eating into what's designated historically as the township zone, pretty much they're all already eating into that.
So to be clear, Ms. Pinnacle, I'm looking at the map on page 6 of Mr. Farr's evidence. Are you talking about the block that he's labelled 13.33 hectares or the township next to it?
Actually both, because that new block there overlays part of the original township. If you just go back one page to page 4 before we overlay the blue piece slightly to the south. So that, that big green knot which heads out into the river, that's completely gone already. So the river's already here. So when we look at the aerial photographs off the website, which has the land marked on it, you can see that whole yellow piece is already missing. You can tell, which is the little blue triangular piece being left in that vicinity as well. The river's right there as well. So I just, you know, I don't know what you do with it, but I just really like to make sure that you're already aware of, and bearing in mind the fact that these photographs are probably 7 to 10 years old, I think you'd find if you had some recent ones, there'd be even more land gone, because the river historically, when my dad first arrived in the valley in the late 1950s, the river was mainly on the Mount Albert side, on the Southern Alps side, but with all the flooding events since, it just keeps moving closer and closer to our side of the valley, the Makura Range side, and eating away more and more of the land. And my dad was farming there up to the late 90s on Makarora Station, so that was approximately 40,000 acres, so it pretty much ran the length of the valley. He put in some extensive flood banks, spent a lot of money on that, and over the years with, you know, flood after flood after flood, most of those are pretty much gone. So I just thought I just really wanted to come along and make that point and feel like I've at least rang some alarm bells and let you guys know. In my original submission, I popped in these two photos of flooding after only 3 inches of rain overnight. And this photo has been taken, if we go back to that page, you're looking at page 6. So it's just after the southern township here. There's a hill and a creek, and it's just before the subdivision here, which luckily is on the right side of the road. The correct side of the road is away from the river, but it's just looking at the flat just to your left in between these two. And I thought it's actually a bit more clearer when I went home last night. I took some photos where you can see the extent of how far the river has come right up through the paddocks towards the road, and all that land there is, it's kind of complicated. When you look at these maps, I've marked in orange on the next page, this is how much, the yellow piece of land we'd lost to the river, and this orange piece is how far that water came up to the rain in just one reasonably common 3 inches of rain overnight flooding event. The other thing, so that's it with this one, when we're talking about how that whole chunk is gone, that central township, is you're pretty close to opposite where the Wilkin River comes out. So obviously when there is a flood event, you've got two rivers meeting there, and that's why it's actually quite extreme, the closeness that the river has come to those quite historic, I don't know when those original townships would have been surveyed off, maybe the late 1800s or early 1900s, I'm not too sure, but obviously those original ones date back to original, and when you're in the valley and it floods, and I've seen the river go from one side to the other in a flood, those three places are the places where if you head to a house we weren't sandbagging it. Either when you come up near the road where the Mickle Country Camp is just there, we had to sandbag that house, which people belongs living in a flood event. So it was kind of on the south side of here. So, I mean, how long's a piece of string? We haven't had a massive flood event for the last 15, 17 odd years. Great. But historically, those were the places to go to not get flooded. That's been borne out by history. But as a lot of that's probably already in the river now, some of it, if you've got recent photos. So I just really wanted to ring those alarm bells. But thank you very much for, you know, everything else that you've considered on my submission. I just happened to sort of stumble upon this as I was gathering bits and pieces and thought I just really wanted to come along and say, number one, thank you very much for your consideration to date, and B, just say, this is what went on like a bit at night hearing it pour down with rain, sort of West Coast rain, I'm thinking, floods, landslides, and just the fact that, I mean, this subdivision here has people who I know subdivided wanting to be able to, their kids have part of that, great. Hutton's down here, I think they're planning maybe motels or selling off sections in the future, but and there, this lake has come up awfully fast too, that they're probably all right, but just looking at this big chunk here out towards the river, even, you know, the proximity, and there's already quite a few houses in this wee section here on Old School Road, awfully close to that river, and it's getting closer every time we flood. So yeah, just to say, I don't know who you passed it on to, and this, I apologise if this wasn't quite the right venue to pass on that information, but it seemed like I needed to.
Well, I think what I draw from your contribution, is that you support Mr. Barr's recommendation to reduce the size of the rural lifestyle zone, but you're raising issues about effectively the susceptibility of those blocks, in particular around the central township area, to flood, for erosion and flooding.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And so, which raises an obvious question as to whether, the initial point is that Mr. Barr needs to take a second look at those provisions from that perspective.
Just for that side in particular, and I didn't realise that earlier, I've only just kind of stumbled upon that once I started comparing
maps,
so I apologise that I didn't get on the radar for my first submission.
Not at all, but part of this exercise is that people are constantly telling us things we don't know, and we're trying to take it on board and figure out what the best way to deal with it is. Commissioner Hudson, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
No, I think I'm good, thanks.
Well, that's me too. But thank you very much. I'm sorry having asked you to come down early, you left your cool in your heels for half an hour. But we really appreciate you, first of all, dropping everything to come down and see us, and for your contribution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll adjourn the hearing until 10 o'clock tomorrow.